Hello and welcome to The Blockchain and Us, where pioneers and thought leaders talk about their journey in blockchain technology, crypto assets, and the token economy. And I'm your host, Manuel Staggers. This episode has support from no official sponsor, but from my very own The Blockchain and Us newsletter. Get an email from me every 2 weeks with a very short summary of new podcast episodes so you can immediately pick those interviews you'd like to listen to. To stay up to date, just visit www.theblockchainandus.com and sign up today. My guest today is Cedric Waldberger. Cedric holds a master's degree in computer science, and he is a serial entrepreneur, startup founder, investor, and blockchain enthusiast since 2012. He co-founded Definity, a blockchain startup backed by Andreessen Horowitz and 8 other high-tech companies in Europe and the US. He also has a video blog where he documents his experiences and travels, and he produces the YouTube series Inside Definity. And now, to the interview. Hi, Cedric, and many thanks for taking time today.
Thanks for having me.
Cedric, I read somewhere that you are never in any one place in the world for more than 3 days. So why is that the case?
My life is very decentralized in many ways. I work on a decentralized project, but even more, my personal life is completely decentralized. There has been for the past 2-3 years. About 2.5 years ago, I gave up on having an apartment anywhere in the world because I realized I'm traveling so much. It was mostly motivated by, at the time, I was part of different companies, and they were all split up in different parts of the world. And then, of course, there's conferences, meetups, retreats. So I found myself at the end of last year, I counted the number of flights that I was on that year. It was almost 120 flights for 2017. And if you average that out, it comes down to no more than roughly 3 days at the same place.
Mm-hmm. And you almost flew to the moon, I think.
Yeah, it was like 80%. Yeah, I summed up the mileage that I made, and I think it was about 80% of the distance between Earth and moon.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's more a necessity for you. It's not something that you chose to do, you know, voluntarily. It just happened.
I think originally I really liked traveling because it allowed me to expose myself to new cultures, new people, new projects. And I always find those are great opportunities to learn and grow as a human. But then also over the past couple of years, there was more and more business travel or more and more trips that I had to go on. So while it may sound fun like to be traveling all the time, but last year was tough, like being in no place more than 3 days, especially if it was like 3 days in Asia, 3 days in the US, 3 days in Europe, and that for a few months at the time. Sometimes it was tough because I felt like I was constantly jet lagged. But I think overall, I would still say I do enjoy travel, and I do enjoy exposing myself to new opportunities to grow.
You were also part of the team that later became Definity. And that's why we're having this interview mainly. So what does Definity do?
Definity, I think, is part of the third generation of blockchain technology. If you think of it as Bitcoin and similar concepts being the first wave, Ethereum and other smart contract platforms being the second wave, I think Definity and other projects are now building on the third generation, which is these more universal computing platforms. We think of Definity as the internet computer. And what we mean by that is not just being able to execute smaller script-like smart contracts, but being able to run completely decentralized applications. We also call them autonomous software or autonomous business models, meaning that you have a way to run projects that will never stop on a completely decentralized infrastructure and have them profit from all the benefits and qualities that the blockchain brings to.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How did you get involved with that team?
Yeah, so I used to work in Berlin on a company called SumUp, which is kind of like the European version of Square. And I was working with a software developer who back then, this was 2012, sometimes he asked me if he could borrow my laptop over lunch to mine some Bitcoins. And that's how I first got introduced to the idea of Bitcoins and blockchain in general. He later on went to Ethereum, helped build out Ethereum, and then later joined Dominic Williams and started brainstorming with him on the ideas for Dfinity. At some point, they realized they probably want to have a component in Switzerland, be it a foundation or something else. This guy remembered that I was a Swiss citizen, that I both had technical experience and business experience. And so we started chatting, and I flew over and immediately got along great with Dom and the rest of the team. Back then, we were about 5 or 6 people. And then I helped set up the Swiss foundation that powers Dfinity to this day, together with Dom. And since then, I've held many different roles in the company. I kind of try to help out wherever I can have an impact.
Mm-hmm. And now, currently, I think you're focusing on the growth of Dfinity, right? How do you do that?
Yeah. So Dfinity is a project that's not live yet. We've been working on our technology for, I think, close to 2 years now. Development is definitely accelerating, and I think launch is most probably going to happen somewhere within the next 6 to 12 months. And as we're getting closer to that date, I think it's so important to also think about how this technology will be used and how it can be showcased. Because I personally believe that even the best technology is only as good as its application. And it's also something that I enjoy thinking about. How can we use blockchain to have an actual impact in our life? Not just the financial systems, but what other areas of our life can it impact? And so as we're getting closer, I'm leading growth in 3 areas: developer applications or adoption, mining, and some of our strategic partnerships. And the way we think about it is providing people with all the materials they need to get up and running. So we're working on explainers, on documentation, on tutorials, on giving people a very easy entry into the blockchain world. One way, or to quote one project, we're working on crypto cartoons. So we're trying to simplify concepts so much that you can basically read comic strips and educate yourself in blockchain.
Okay. But that's got nothing to do with CryptoKitties.
No, that's completely unrelated.
You said it's Dfinity. The goal of Dfinity is to be the internet computer. What would be maybe a consumer application of that?
Yeah, so Dfinity is an infrastructure project. So we think of us as kind of like the BGP and TCP of the internet, right? Not a specific website, but it should be able to power all kinds of different consumer applications. I think the more obvious ones that we all know are any application that touches the financial system, insurances, banking, and all that. I'm personally extremely passionate about governance and education and identity as well. I think identity is something that we hear a lot about, governance as well, with more and more systems adopting an on-chain governance system. Education, I think, might not be as obvious at the beginning. But I think once you have governance and you have identity, we could have a huge impact on education. So this is a personal thought experiment that I like to discuss with friends. I think education could be the big equalizer of the 21st century. I believe that if we gave everyone in the world to educate themselves in the same way that I had the opportunity here in Switzerland, and we managed to bring an education system that truly scales to those parts of the world where infrastructure is not as built out as here in Switzerland, I think it could have a huge impact. And one way I think about it is that our education system could kind of split into two parts. One, I call them content and form, where content, I think, is there. We have tons of books, online courses, papers. The knowledge is there, right? Wikipedia and so on. And also distribution is kind of solved with digital content and having cell phones all over the world. The other part I think is more tricky, which is form, or I call it form. I think it's extremely important to learn and teach in communities. But I'm not sure the setup that we have right now, where you have usually like 20 learners against one teacher, and one teacher for all types of learners, and a randomly assigned teacher, might not be the best going forward. So I'm thinking if there's a way that we can teach communities to teach themselves, if we can get people to come together and learn stuff together and show each other what they've learned, I think that could be extremely powerful. And I think the blockchain could come in at the point where I'm sure you've hired people before, and We all, even though we all learn online, we still give so much credit to schools and GPAs and all those like traditional accreditations. And I think a big reason for that is that we think that online courses can be faked, right? Because if you solve an online course, send me the solutions, I can go through it in like 5 to 10 minutes. So I think if we focused less on these like static tests and more on like applications, me showing that I've really learned about blockchain by building a blockchain and showing everyone around me, and then those people giving me, I call them trust vectors, or they could be called exam vectors or something like that. That could be a powerful concept where I do not only get verification from one person, but from like a group of people.
So it's basically like combining MOOCs, right? Massive open online courses with some kind of accreditation system.
Yeah, I think the important part there is to have an online identity that's a one-to-one mapping to real-life identities, so that later on, if I see that someone gave you a certain feedback on what you've done, I can also see what kind of qualifications that person had.
I'm always interested in storytelling and in telling the story of blockchain technology. And that's a big motivation for me to do this podcast, but also to make when I made my films. So you also have a vlog where you focus on storytelling. And how did that project start?
Yeah, I'll go back a few years to give you some context. A few years ago, I realized that what makes me truly happy is learning, growing as a person, understanding concepts and how things in the world work. And once I understood that, I started creating lots and lots of different learning opportunities for myself, both in business by joining multiple projects, but then also just by having fun experiments every now and then. And one thing I've recently realized is that if I want to further scale my time or leverage my time, I need to have a bigger team, and I need to make sure there needs to be less communication, which means I can not only transfer like the kind of the bullet points for what each and everyone has to do right now, but I need to be sure that everyone understands my incentives and interests in the long run.
It's about getting people on the same page.
Not just getting them on the same page, but also understanding them how I feel about certain things. And I felt like that was often something that got lost in the past, because I was very good at giving you ABC, but I was not very good at giving you the information that goes between the lines and gives you feedback on how I feel about something or what's my long-term goal with this.
Mm-hmm. What's an example of how you feel about something? I mean, how would you translate that in a video, you know, on your vlog?
Yeah, so and then the vlog was basically what I realized is I need to get better at storytelling to give people not only information, but also emotions. And that's how I started the 90-day vlogging challenge. I kind of see my life not in years, but in quarters. And that's why I decided to run the experiment for 91 days and produce one movie or one vlog per day, one episode per day. And it's been extremely fun, but also extremely challenging, as I'm sure you know, working in with similar ideas and projects.
It's so much more work than everybody thinks.
Yes, boiling down 24 hours into a few minutes per day. It's been extremely fun. It's also a great way of journaling and looking back, like having memories now. To come back to your question, what are the things that I covered? Like for those 91 days, everything. Like whatever, my goal was always to share one thing that I've learned or that I wanted to pass on from that day to my audience, to whoever was watching the vlogs. So it was very wide ranging, from travel tips to how I deal with jet lag, to what are the 64 things that I own, to what is Dfinity and how do we build Dfinity. After the 91 days were over, I decided not to go forward with daily vlogging, but to keep producing videos, but in a more focused area. And I'm now running this format called Inside Dfinity, where I talk about anything that's related to Dfinity. So it could be ideas that we have and think will exist on top of Dfinity. It could be featuring people from our community, but also very importantly, showing who works on Dfinity and what do these people do every day.
Mm-hmm. But have you seen direct results, you know, from you telling these stories with videos to, you know, better collaborations, better results in your team?
I think so. I mean, One cool side effect was that producing these videos, my team would also see them, and they automatically got a lot of context for who I am and how I work and how I think. And that's also something that I can just pass on to new hires, or I can point to a specific episode.
And maybe the important is that your team obviously is also decentralized, so you're not sitting maybe in the same office all the time.
Yeah, so for Dfinity, we have two main offices, one in the States and one here in Zurich. But then we also, as it's very common in the space, we have a few people working remotely and distributed. And part of that means that you have to be better at communication than anyone else, just because you only get a limited amount of face-to-face time every day or every week or month. What's one takeaway? I think I've become better at grasping where to start a story and where to end it, and give enough context. And when I talk about our goals for our business goals, I also try to frame them in the way I try to set up my story. So setup, conflict, and resolution. So what's the background information you need to know? Status, where do we stand now? What's the problem we're facing? And then what are some potential ways we're going to solve that problem?
Like a classic three-act structure, yes, almost. Yeah. Okay. There's something interesting. Do you know this story circle?
I don't.
Yeah, it's basically, it's an 8-step process. And I found it, I've done all my films with that, and I found it works actually quite well, especially for technical subject matter. But maybe I can share it with you later.
Yeah, that'd be great.
So let's talk a little bit more about Dfinity. The Dfinity Foundation is in Switzerland, in Zug, and you're from Switzerland, and one of your backers is Andreessen Horowitz. So why did it make sense for you, coming from Switzerland, to look for funding in Silicon Valley?
Yeah, I think part of that is that we have our largest research center right now in Palo Alto, very close to Sand Hill Road, where Andreessen sits. And then Andreessen was not the only backer. We ran, at the beginning of 2017, a smaller ICO. And we decided not to run a second ICO, but go with private investors, traditional investors. And Andreessen and Polychain led our recent round at the beginning of 2018. And we mainly chose them because they bring a huge amount of knowledge and extra help to the table besides their funding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would have been my next question. If you do an ICO, why also go for venture capital? So you said it, before. You said knowledge and networks. But what else?
Yeah, I think we kind of, we did our ICO at the beginning of 2017. We were still one of the very first ICOs before the big, what's now called the ICO craze in the summer of 2017. What we've realized pretty quickly is that there's many unanswered questions with ICOs. How are they going to be treated 5 or 10 years down the road? And we just didn't want to take on the risk and risk the project on some regulations that were just not finalized at the time. And that's why we saw ourselves forced to go back, take a step back, and reassess what's the best way to get funding. I think at that point, we also saw a lot of value in bringing on some strategic backers and traditional VCs, even if it meant maybe smaller rounds and longer education. And most importantly, not as being as decentralized or distributed when it comes to who owns our tokens. But also for that, we found a pretty elegant way. We've recently ran an airdrop. We've distributed over 35 million Swiss francs worth of token to our community members. A total of over 50,000 people have participated in that airdrop. And we saw that as a good way to balance out the fact that we had to go with, or that we chose to go with, private investors in the second fundraise.
Before we started recording, we talked a little bit about differences between Dfinity and other blockchain startups. And to pick up there again, I want to ask you, in your opinion, what does Dfinity do uniquely different to other startups in the blockchain space?
Sure. Yeah. One thing that comes to mind, and obviously this is from a somewhat biased perspective, right? I'm a part of Dfinity from the very start, and it's the only project that I'm part of, so I don't see the others. But from the inside, but I feel we try to do things in a more, or we often do things in a more traditional way, a bit more conservative. And I think it is because we're all in for the very long term. Also, if you come to our offices versus some other projects, you'll see that we have real offices. People come there from 9 to 5 or, well, mostly it's longer days, but we have people at the office every day. We believe that it makes a lot of sense to bring people together in front of a whiteboard to brainstorm things. And then also we've hired a lot of very senior people over the last year or so. We've brought on people with a lot of experience in the academic industry or like academic area of blockchain or math and computer science. And that's also one for me, that's the number one thing why I chose to contribute all my time to Dfinity. I get to work with some amazing people. I feel like every day my head is about to explode because I learned so much. And that's just something I'm extremely grateful for.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Cedric, what was your first company?
My first company is actually where we're sitting right now. We're sitting at MediaSign, which is a media agency based in Rapperswil in Switzerland. And it kind of happened by, I wouldn't say accident, but it was definitely not as planned as some of the later ventures. It started with a very good friend of mine and me working on websites. This was around the 2000s when everyone wanted a website, even though they didn't know what to use it for. And I was just a kid being very happy when I was sitting in front of a computer and programming or developing websites. And my friend was a graphic designer, so we teamed up and started doing things. And over time, it has developed to this company that does about employs about 15 people and does everything from like corporate branding to websites.
Mm-hmm. Did you always want to be an entrepreneur?
I think I've always been. So the thing that drives me is creative problem solving. And I think being an entrepreneur just allows you to face all kinds of creative problems every single day, more often than you want it. I was not naturally someone that wanted to stand out or be in front of people or lead, I think, for the first 15 years of my life or so. And when we started MediaSign, I was 14 at the time. My friend was 18, so he was able to set up the company back then. And from the very beginning, we had a very clear idea of everyone's roles. So he was clearly the front end, outward facing, marketing, sales, and I would take care of all the details, finance, and a lot of the development. And I think that's a lesson that has served me really well ever since, is to pick your team and be very clear about who has which strengths and which weaknesses, and accordingly set up your team.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So when you were 14, you were fully involved in business already?
So it was not full time. I was still in high school at the time, but I was very fortunate that everything in school up and until ETH, my university, came pretty easy to me. So I had a lot of free time. Some of my teachers didn't even require me to come to school. I could just write the exams. And so I had a bit of time on my hand. And starting a business or working on websites and educating myself just seemed like a really good use of my time back then, and a lot of fun as well. But I mean, it was more of a weekend plus like some weeknights kind of project back then. And then we ramped up pretty quickly. When I was 18 or 19, we had, I think, the first 2 or 3 people employed. And then from there, it went on to like 10 to 15.
When you look around at other entrepreneurs and maybe also at your own journey, and maybe if you could do it again, you know, if you could go back 10 years or 20 years, are there things you do different or that you advise people that you see start a company, look into maybe with more care or do differently altogether?
I think realizing that I was so young at the time, and I'm still considering myself young, I was always looking for mentors and people I could learn from, people that would share their experience with me. And that's definitely something that I would recommend everyone starting out in any kind of field, whether it's as an entrepreneur or any other profession, to copy. I think that was the single greatest driver inside of me that allowed me to advance quickly. And I like this quote, smart men learn from their mistakes, wise men learn from other people's mistakes, right? And I've always kind of made that my credo. I was always very open to sharing my experience. I also try to pass on a lot of my experience to anyone in my network that wants to learn from my past experience. And that would be my number one recommendation to anyone starting out.
But is that something you see people do? Not look for role models, not look for mentors, and just try to kind of muddle through on their own?
I think there's different levels, as with everything in life. I think there's also, there needs to be chemistry between someone that you want to get advice from, right? And someone you want to learn from, and that might not always be there. I think I've seen a few, from my perspective, looked like very stubborn founders. And sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. So I'm not saying it's definitely right or wrong to go either way, but just for myself, I think I've profited a lot from the experience that other people were sharing with me.
Mm-hmm. So basically the idea of never be the smartest guy in the room.
Yes. Yeah. I do this thing. I mentioned it earlier. I measure my life not in years, but in quarters. And so every 90 days, I kind of take an afternoon and evening off, and I write about 12 areas of my life. And I ask myself, where do I stand? Where do I want to go in those 12 areas? And it could be anything from like friends and family to money, personal growth, passions, and so on. And one thing that I often ask myself in the area of friends is, who are the five people that I spent the most time with, and what did I learn from them within the last 90 days? And then I also ask myself, who are the five people that I should have spent the most time with? And if there's a difference between the two sets, then I try to course correct, or at least spend more time with the people that I felt I didn't spend enough time with.
Mm-hmm. Cool. That's a good one. Do you also do this exercise with your team?
So I don't do it openly. So we don't necessarily read out what we do. But we, for example, with my team at Definity, the people that I work with daily, we do a feedback cycle every 6 weeks, which sounds like a lot, especially if, some traditional companies that I've seen, they do it once a year, which I think is nonsense. Why would you wait a year to give someone feedback? And we do it in a very simple way. We use a Google form, and basically we ask, I would get feedback from everyone. They would say start, stop, continue. So start is what would they like me to start doing? Stop is what would they like me to stop doing? And continue, what would they like me to do more? And so it's very open. It's not about like personality versus skills and so on. So the idea is that it's quick, and that it surfaces the most pressing issues or pressing feedback points that they want to give or pass on to me.
Is this something you learned from a mentor, or how did you learn how to do these things?
So the start, stop, continue is something that I've picked up in an organization called Entrepreneurs Organization. It's a worldwide network for entrepreneurs, which I'm part of. They have a Zurich chapter as well, which has been great. Lots and lots of people sharing their experiences and tips with me. And then the feedback cycle, doing it every 6 weeks, is something that we decided on within the team, just because we're all very hungry for feedback. And given that we often work remote, we felt it's good to be extra vocal about our feedback and pay extra attention to giving feedback quickly and openly.
You're also an investor. And I'm wondering, do you have a specific focus when you invest?
So I think it shifts a bit over time. But when we started Tendalone Ventures, which is the investment company that we set up, the initial focus were two baskets. One is e-commerce in Switzerland. And the thesis there is that Amazon will not enter the Swiss market for a while. And therefore, there's an opportunity for high margin niche markets. So I invested in a few e-commerce companies. And then the other basket is a bit more open, openly defined. The thesis there is that there's a lot of value in companies that scale without adding staff. And so the requirement for that second basket is that if a company is up and running, then it should be able to serve 1,000 to 10,000 additional users or customers without adding a single staff. Yeah, those were the two baskets that we invested in. We've invested into our first batch of 10 companies between 2014 and end of 2016, so over 3 years. Right now, I'm kind of in a period of where I assess how those investments are doing. And then personally, I invest in different crypto projects right now, or blockchain projects that I think are interesting and have value in the long run. And there I mostly invest right now into infrastructure projects, because I believe that it's too early for many of the application layer projects. First, we need to establish which is going to be the platform where most of these applications can run on. And then will come a time and era for all these applications on top of it.
Do you also invest in ICOs?
I have invested in the Dfinity coin offering that we did back then. But I've actually never invested in any other ICO.
Why not?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think it's part trust. I like to spend a lot of time with a team before investing in them. And I felt like mostly only after they've gone live and showed significant progress, I gained enough trust to back a project. And then I think maybe a smaller component is also convenience. I just felt more comfortable investing through exchanges versus having to go through the KYC and AML process with each and every project. Mm.
But with the blockchain projects you invest in, how do you invest? I mean, do you buy equity or how do you do that?
Maybe I should also say I'm not a huge investor in anything outside my own projects. So it's more of I invest for learning. I kind of like when I like a project, I put some money down to make sure I keep being interested in that project and I naturally just follow it.
Like the people who buy one stock and then they get to go to the shareholders meeting.
Yeah, like this. Except there's no shareholders meetings. Usually it's all online. But yeah, I think the motivation can be compared. Yeah, I kind of like it as a reminder to myself to stay interested or to follow up with a project.
No, I was just wondering because my next question would be, how do you evaluate those investments, right? And if you say, okay, I'm mainly investing because I'm interested in the field, I want to stay up to date, then of course that's a decision, right? That's something you're interested in and then you invest in something, but you try to minimize the downside by not investing too much. But when you invest in entrepreneurs, you know, in real teams, you mentioned a few things already that you find important with entrepreneurs, but how do you go about evaluating those teams? Okay.
So I'll try to finish the question that you asked me before and then
move forward to this. Yeah. Sure.
So maybe I should also add, I'm not too diversified because what I've learned over time and from my past experience in the non-blockchain world is that I make my biggest gains in my own projects, not by investing in others. I also think it's more fun to focus on my project and help it get as far as possible instead of just putting down money on other projects. And so I think it's more educational money that I would look. I would look at my investments more as educational money than at real investments like we did with Tenderloin Ventures. Tenderloin Ventures was a period where this like first batch of 10 companies was a period where I wanted to parallelize my learning process. So I wanted to be part of 10 companies and spend all my time on those 10 companies and see what worked well and what didn't. Now that I'm back in the driver's seat at my own project, I'm trying to reserve as much focus and energy for that project versus any others and avoid as many distractions as possible.
Let's take a quick break for a message from our sponsors. This episode has support from no official sponsor, but from my very own The Blockchain and Us newsletter. Get an email from me every 2 weeks with a very short summary of new podcast episodes so you can immediately pick those interviews you'd like to listen to. To stay up to date, just visit www.theblockchainandus.com and sign up today.
Interesting. Do you think there's a difference between, you know, maybe a tech entrepreneur and a blockchain entrepreneur?
Huh. I think there's very different types of blockchain entrepreneurs. I think there's a type that is a tech entrepreneur where they built core technology. They're very passionate about product and the technology that they're building. And then there's a different category, at least one other category, which I think are often coming from the financial sector. And they operate on a different level. So they use the infrastructure that's already built for brokerages, for hedge funds, trading. and everything related to financial services. And I typically see a difference between those two. But when it comes to tech entrepreneurs in the blockchain space, I think they're very similar. I think one of the interesting differences to what we've seen in the traditional tech space is that right now there's a lot of money flowing into the blockchain space. And so it's interesting to see how quickly teams scale out and also how responsible people handle their funds and what they are able to achieve within the first year, 2 or 3 years. I think it could have, in a traditional tech industry, it typically takes a bit longer until you raise the amount of funds that were raised in like very early stage ICOs in the past year. And so it's interesting to see how these projects will do now that they've, on the financial side, have been so fast-tracked.
Mm-hmm. But have you seen with the rise of blockchain technology or the, you know, maybe also the popularity of starting companies in this field, have you seen entirely new traits maybe come up in entrepreneurs that you previously didn't see in, you know, previous waves of technology?
Without naming anyone specifically, but I think there's a high percentage or a lot of geniuses in the space, which to me fascinates me and totally draws me to the space. I think there's a lot of people that have a lot of talent, are extremely talented in what they do. And that's something that I find extremely attractive about the space.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is?
I think it's groundbreaking. I think blockchain as a technology just allows us to do so many new things and apply to so many areas of our lives that it's kind of like a green field. And so it's very, I think there's a high return on time for anyone who's really talented to think about how blockchain could be applied to make their life and the lives of millions of other people better or at least impacted.
Mm-hmm. Because of the ICOs.
I don't think it's just ICOs, because I think you can also, if you look at some of the earlier projects which didn't raise these huge sums, I think just the idea of being able to have an impact on so many people's lives and do groundbreaking work and really create something truly new, it's just enticing to a lot of smart people. I think there's a lot of people that are intrinsically motivated to do really well in this space and to build something big and impact lots of people and lives. And I think that's another component that is really attractive to me about the space.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, the same could be said about the web, right? I mean, the web huge impacts, but I mean, maybe, I'm not sure, do you think there were also that many geniuses in that first dot-com boom?
So I wasn't fully conscious back then. I was 12 or 13 when the dot-com bubble burst, at least. But from what I can read and observe from my position now, I think there's been a lots and lots of visionaries. I mean, if you think of Jeff Bezos, right, who started Amazon way before the dot-com bubble, and it's kind of only reaping the fruit of that, I'd say, within the last 5 to 10 years. I mean, that guy has so much willpower and long-term vision. I find it truly amazing.
You know, you mentioned geniuses before, and I want to ask something that I think is maybe related to that, and that's decision-making. Because I mean, I sometimes struggle with decisions. I mean, sometimes I take a long time to make decisions, and then often, more often than not, they're wrong or not so good at the end. But what personally in your work or in your life, what helps you make better decisions?
So I believe in this theory of decision fatigue, meaning that you only have a certain amount of bigger and smaller decisions that you can make per day. So when it comes to decision making for me, I try to be very conscious about which decisions I allow myself to make and which ones I don't allow myself to make. So back when I started to minimalize and cut down everything that I own to just the stuff that fits into a backpack, I also made the decision to only own black things. And one reason for that was that, I mean, picking a color is just an extra decision you need to make that doesn't have, in my worldview or my value system, doesn't have any positive return. And so there's a few reasons why everything that I own is black, one of them being minimalizing the amount of decisions. Once I know I need a certain type of iPad, I just get it in black. Or once I know I need to get a certain type of shoes, I get it in black. And there's another few benefits that come with that. I can only wash once. Everything fits well together. And then something that also comes in handy, given that I travel every few days, is that I often stay at places that have white bedding, hotels and Airbnbs, and it's much harder to lose a black shirt in a white bed than a white shirt.
Yeah, good point. Excellent. How about food? Because, I mean, I find that's also a big drain on decisions.
Yeah, I experiment a lot. I wouldn't say I've totally cracked it. One thing that serves me well is the ketogenic diet, where I basically train my body to get energy from fat instead of simple sugars. And that also helps me to just very often just eat once per day. So very often I would either have lunch or dinner, which also saves a lot of time and decisions. And then what I often do when I go to a restaurant, for example, I just ask for, can I get something that has meat and salad or vegetables without even looking at the menu? Plus, it kind of like, it's a good conversation starter, and it sometimes leads to interesting conversations and menu items that weren't even on the menu. Yeah, I think that's as far as I've reduced the food decisions to.
I mean, I found personally that it helps me a lot to eat the same thing always. I mean, for each meal, eating the same thing helped me, you know, save time at restaurants, saving time at looking through menus, but also shopping and all of that becomes very simple all of a sudden, you know.
I agree. The problem for me is that I travel to so many different cultures and places that it's hard for me, like, unless I go to McDonald's, there's rarely a restaurant that offers the same menu. And also, I've experimented with Soylent, the powder that you shake and it should replace a full meal, but just going through airports with powder has become such a pain within the last few years, and then also I cannot carry unlimited amounts of it, and getting it in time in different places of the world is just hard. So that didn't work out to me. The ketogenic diet, or just vegetables and meat, or let's just say vegetables and proteins, works to the degree that I was able to experience it so far, works pretty well in all kinds of cuisines over the world.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Good point. You mentioned a few times those 64 things that you own.
Yeah.
And now you just said it has to do with decision-making too. But are there other reasons for that kind of minimalism?
Yeah, so I really like questions that sound simple but don't have a simple answer. Stuff like what makes you happy, which we talked about earlier. At first, I didn't have a clear answer to it, so I decided to spend some time and explore that. And then at some point, someone asked me I might even have asked myself, like, how much stuff do I own? Which sounded like such a simple question, but in practice, I didn't have an idea whether it was 200 things or 500 or 2,000 things. At the time, I was already traveling for like 3 or 4 years, not as often as I do now, but still frequently. So I felt like I was pretty lean, but I didn't know. And so what I did is I started creating a spreadsheet. I walked through back then I still had an apartment, started going through my apartment and indexing every single thing that I owned. And it came out to about 640 things. What I realized is that, well, I'm very numbers driven. I'm very left brained. And as soon as I had that number, 640 items, I kind of wanted to know how little can I go and still be fully functional. The other thing that really attracted me was, why do I still have an apartment, even if I'm only in Zurich for like 3 to 5 days per month? And sometimes I would catch myself going back to Zurich just because I felt like I have an apartment, I might as well use it. Even though my time would have been better spent, let's say in the US or somewhere else where I could have contributed value to one of the projects.
Do you see yourself keep doing this with the 64 things?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, the term has kind of like developed its own life, 64 things, right? Where I didn't necessarily plan to own just 64 things. It's more of a means to an end for me. The end being happy. everything I do in my life ultimately should lead to me being happier or the people around me being happier, which in turn will make me happier. And 64 things, or just owning 64 things right now, allows me to spend as much time as possible with projects all around the world that I'm truly curious about. So I think that the answer is, I'll keep doing it as long as it makes me happy. And if I feel at some point that I'd be happier if I had a fixed place or a place where I spend all my time, then I would probably work towards that again. The one thing that I want to try and stick to is being conscious about how much stuff I own. Because I feel we live in a world where very often we make decisions just because we feel we can get something at a discount. And I don't think that's necessarily the best motivation to make that decision. So I think I'll always try to be very conscious about how much stuff I own and giving away stuff that I don't need anymore, because maybe there's someone else that can get more value from it.
I mean, for several years, I tried something similar. You know, I had one carry-on suitcase and a backpack. That was all I had on me. And I was traveling maybe for about 3 years. And but then I started making these films. And as you know, right, you need lenses and you need light and you need cables and microphones and backups and tripods and all of that stuff. And then there was all this bulk all of a sudden. But now slowly I'm trying to kind of, you know, go back there again, because I find it very fascinating and helpful.
Yeah, and we talked about it before we started talking now. And I mean, your setup for this, the quality is extremely high, but your setup is actually extremely low. Like, it all fits into 1/3 of a backpack.
That's true. But think about it. You know, what we have now is maybe already 50 things, just the setup to record this interview. And I mean, right? I mean, once we start counting, it quickly goes up in the numbers. But you're right, it is compact. I'm very conscious of that. But it's just now maybe I have 2 suitcases, 1 carry-on and a backpack. And so that's just the reality of it, unfortunately.
I often try to think about it as like a 20-80 principle kind of thing. So I also allow myself to buy, let's say, 4 different lenses, but then I'll give away 3 after like a month or so. Once I've figured out which one does the job most of the time. Because I have my stuff on my back every single day, right? So like carrying an extra lens, like I'll feel it. And so that's kind of like a natural selection criteria. Like if I carry something around for 30 days and I haven't used it yet, or I have never used it again in those 30 days, then I just have a natural interest to let go of it and give it away.
Mm. You grew up in Switzerland. I mean, you mentioned that a few times. And did you ever find that this gave you an advantage or a disadvantage in any of your projects?
I think, now that I've traveled so many parts of the world, I think I'm very fortunate that I was born and raised here in Switzerland. I think the education system here is phenomenal, and just the amount of safety and convenience that we get to enjoy here in Switzerland is great. So yes, it has definitely benefited me. It has definitely helped me get a head start against some other people that grew up in less fortunate areas of the world. On the culture side, I think it's very interesting to think about that. I think there's the Swiss person is a bit more conservative than the typical American entrepreneur, maybe, or South American entrepreneur, or African entrepreneur. We're all different. I think as long as you become conscious of who you are and what your value system is and what culture you belong to, then I think it's not an advantage or disadvantage. It's just a set of tools that you were given.
I mean, we spoke about location a few times. So I just asked you about being from Switzerland, what that is doing for you. How long do you think it will take until there is no difference at all where somebody's coming from, or where a company is located, or where the customers of a company are? What's your view on this?
I think that's great. That's a great question, and something that I often think about. I have this other thought experiment where I think about a blockchain state, and the blockchain state is something that governs things in our life that are not inherently physical. So I believe that the states that we have right now, they emerged obviously because people that lived close together, they had similar interests and values just by the design of how they were living. But now that's not true anymore, right? We all think about different parts of the world. We all travel. We all have friends all over the world. And so I think it would make more sense to split it up and use these traditional states as what I call infrastructure states. And they help us take care of infrastructure, because I'll always have an interest in this road outside this building here, where someone in the US will not have an interest in that being upkept and maintained. But there's so many things like education or our financial systems, insurance, to some degree, medical care, that are not physical, or at least not inherently physical. And I think those should be governed by something that is larger than our infrastructure states. Now, when do I think this will become a reality? I think maybe in some parts of the world it could become a reality sooner than we think. Estonia is extremely forward-thinking when it comes to electronic residency. I just got my e-residency a couple of weeks ago. So now, without even going to Estonia, I can open bank accounts, I can create companies, which I think is a first great step towards that direction. I know Dubai and some states in South America are very forward-thinking when it comes to mapping their infrastructure and government onto the blockchain and more transparent systems. So I'm very curious to see what we're going to see in the next few years and how these concepts will develop.
How important, or maybe also with Definity, since you're working in this project very actively, how important do you think will blockchain technology become, you know, in the future in general?
I think it will probably become more important in certain areas of our lives where we don't expect it, and less important in other areas of our life where we do expect it right now. I mean, that's the cool thing about being alive right now. So much is changing. Research is accelerating faster and faster. There's new applications and projects and ideas every single day. And that's what excites me. In terms of what I think, I think we just have to get there and see what happens. I think it's so hard to make prognoses. They're always going to be wrong. I like to think everything should change. And I'm not going to be unhappy if not everything changes, just a few things. But I feel there's a lot of disruption coming, or there should be a lot of disruption coming in a good way.
Mm-hmm. Let's go forward maybe 15 years and say all of what you mentioned will happen, and all the things that you hope will change will change. How would you characterize that kind of world that we'd be living in?
So let's say we manage to bring education or similar types of education to the whole world, also rural areas, and we have this overarching blockchain state that we all have a direct democracy in, or liquid democracy. I think it could make the world more open and more fair. And I think if the world becomes more fair, more equal, I think that would also lead to all of us being a bit more content, a bit more happy in the end, because we don't feel like anyone else has something that they don't deserve, or the world was unjust to someone or to myself. But of course, there's going to be other problems as well. I mean, as with every larger system or an institution in our lives, there's also potential for it to affect more and more people, larger diseases, hacks. I think in summary, I would say I'm excited for that vision. But I'm also cautious that there are going to be downsides, as with everything in life.
Mm-hmm. What do you think most blockchain experts maybe still misunderstand about what the technology can do?
I think this notion of the internet computer or decentralized infrastructure is pretty new to some people in the space. And this idea of running autonomous businesses and autonomous systems that completely govern themselves, that are owned by its users, is extremely interesting and is, I think, something that we're going to hear a lot more about in the next 12 to 24 months.
But again, what do you think is a misunderstanding? Maybe people even working in the space themselves may have.
I think it's just that some people think that blockchain just means Bitcoin, but I don't think those are the experts, right? But a lot of people that are currently invested in some coins or feel like they've learned about the space, they think that it's always just going to be a token transfer network, and it's always just going to be for financial systems, because that was the first application. So I think that would be the biggest understanding that I see with some people in the space.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In your work or maybe in life in general, who are your role models?
There's this guy, Richard Feynman. He was a physicist. I read his book. I think it was called Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman. That I often think of him. He has such a joyful way of looking at life and seeing everything as a challenge that's kind of thrown his way. He lost his wife early on. And I think he just saw that as yet another challenge to grow as a person and become someone better. So I think he's one of the people that I often think of when I have to make a big decision or when I think about how I'm living life. I think he's definitely an inspiration.
What are you still learning as an entrepreneur?
Oh, everything. I feel like I'm at 5%. I think the best part about being an entrepreneur is you get to work with lots and lots of different people. And people are also the best and the worst part of being an entrepreneur. Like just being able to foresee in which position someone will perform best is such an interesting challenge. Something that I'm constantly working on, taking notes, trying to come up with experiments and tests and ideas of how I can better foresee someone's personality type or how they will react in a certain role or position. So that's definitely a big part. I think more concretely right now, I'm working on a lot on communication. Like what's the best way to work with people that I don't constantly interface with in real life? We have two offices now, one in Zurich and one in Palo Alto. So there's quite a bit of distance and time difference between the two places. So I think communication, people, and then of course, I also like to geek out and just learn a lot about technology and figure out how things work and play with it.
If you had one wish to change anything, maybe in the world or in your life, what would that be?
This is kind of random, but we talked about Switzerland earlier. If I could make one wish or one rule, it would be that everyone in Switzerland has to travel for at least a year early in their life. Mm-hmm. Because we live in a very, very fortunate place, but it's also a bit of an island. It's not how the rest of the world is, and the rest of the world makes up 99% of all the world. I think it'd be good to get perspective for some people. I'm not saying Swiss people in general don't have that perspective, but I think it's just for me, it's been a very, it's been an experience that really broadened my horizons when I first started traveling and first left Switzerland for a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally hear you. I mean, I think for everybody, it's good to get some perspective and just to move around a bit and see how other people live. I think that helps anyone almost.
I think just understanding that there's not just one right way to do things. And seeing that other people live in different cultures, different systems, different value perceptions is something that could help us all.
So, Cedric, how can people find you or get in touch with you?
Yeah, they can find me on almost all platforms. I mean, there's Cedric Waldberger or Cedi Waldberger on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube. Go check out the vlogs and please give me feedback, especially. I'm interested to hear how I can do better. How you think my thinking can be challenged. And of course, if you have some positive comments as well, then that can be a great conversation starter as well.
How do you think I can do better in this interview?
No, I think you did a great job. We covered quite a few areas of my life and my interests. I hope we can stay in touch and talk a bit more about and geek out about equipment and how to run things smoothly. Mm-hmm. And especially, we should have a follow-up conversation on what your process looks like for editing all this. Because what people might not realize listening to this is that doing the interview is just a small part of the work that goes into...
The smallest part.
The smallest part of anything that we publish, right? Mm. So it'd be great to be to stay in touch and share experiences of how we both structure our processes.
Mm-hmm. Cool. But still, I'm curious about this. What's one suggestion you think I should have done better so I can learn something?
Yes, let me think. So I didn't feel like you were 100% conscious at all time because I know you have your laptop in front of you, you have the timer running next to you, and it sometimes slightly distracted me, seeing you go somewhere else with your mind, even if it was only for a split second. But that's really the only thing I could pass on.
Yeah, I definitely have to be more mindful of that in the future. And there's so much more to do better, improve, and learn for me as well, of course. Cedric, I really had a great time. I really enjoyed your insight and your openness. And I thank you very much for taking time today.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us today. More info on our guests and our sponsors is in the show notes of this episode and on the podcast website, theblockchainandus.com. To help people find this podcast, it's important that you download, subscribe, and give it a top rating and review on iTunes or on the podcast platform of your choice. I'm Manuel Staggers, and I thank you very much for listening.